The views expressed on the Final Straw Radio do not necessarily reflect those of Asheville FM, Friends of Community Radio, or any of the affiliate stations airing the show. You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard in KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWA in Olympia, Washington, and WCRS in Columbus, Ohio. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. Also, if you're interested in rebroadcasting any episode or segment, you are free to do so. Just send us an email so we know you're out there. If you care to, you can send us letters at The Final Straw Radio, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806. This week's show features a conversation with Ariana Steger, daughter of long-term eco-anarchist prisoner in the U.S., Marius Mason. Marius is serving 22 years for destruction of a GMO, genetically modified organism, research facility at the University of Michigan, as well as pieces of logging equipment. Marius was part of the so-called Green Scare, the FBI and U.S. government's hunt and repression of eco-activists. In Marius's case, his ex-husband, Frank Ambrose, was coerced into snitching on Marius about their eco-defense activities in exchange for a partially deferred sentence. Marius is also a trans man who transitioned while incarcerated and is being held in a women's facility. Marius is frequently put in isolation for his continued organizing around issues of trans prisoners and access to vegan food. This conversation is taking place on the weekend before the annual June 11th Day of Solidarity with long-term anarchist and eco-prisoners, including Marius Mason. June 11th, formerly the Day of Solidarity with Jeffrey Free Lures, has for years now been an opportunity for discussion and organizing, fundraising, and active solidarity with those on the other side of the bars, in hopes to continue their struggles towards a world without bars and without cages. More on June 11th, the prisoners involved, and the like can be found at June11th.org. In this hour, Ariana, who was 16 at the time of Marius' arrest, talks about her relationship with him, about activism, music, incarceration, family, and time. We'll hear some of Ariana's music in the hour, but if you want to hear a more complete interview, including more of Ariana's music, check out our podcast version of the show. If you'd like to check out Ariana's music, listen to soundcloud.com/Ariana's Tiger. That's Ariana, A-R-I-A-N-N-A, S-T-Y-G-E-R. Special thanks to Dino Sorceress for conducting today's interview.
This week in Asheville, there will be two June 11th events. On Friday, June 10th at French Broad River Park at 6:30 p.m., there will be a potluck barbecue with some free and benefit materials available, plus food and conversation on prisons, long-term prisoners and solidarity, and probably tempeh. On Saturday, June 11th at 6:30 p.m. at Firestorm Books and Coffee, there will be a showing of the Critical Resistance documentary, Visions of Abolition, From Critical Resistance to a New Way of Life, followed by a discussion of the prison industrial complex and prison abolitionism. This event is free, and you're free to bring some friends.
If you can make it to Washington, D.C., this week there will be actions against the Bureau of Prisons and other targets, as well as community gatherings in parallel with June 11th against the ecological and health damages caused by prisons, in particular focusing on actions against the construction of a new prison in Kentucky on a former mountaintop removal site. For more information about this, check out our interview with folks from Fight Toxic Prisons or check out fighttoxicprisons.wordpress.com. Before we get on with our Sean Swain segment and the interview, some quick announcements.
A national mobilization is being planned in Sacramento in several weeks, and we need your help to make it possible. In the past year, the anarchist movement has seen the rise of the far right and the growth of white nationalism and fascism, not only in the U.S., but throughout the world. From neo-Nazis marching to support the police in Olympia, mass shootings carried out by white nationalists, to people almost getting shot in Minneapolis outside of a protest encampment, to everyone from the KKK and the militia movement coming back in a real way. On Sunday, June 26th, the Traditionalist Worker Party, headed by white power rising star Matthew Heimbach, will be leading the neo-Nazi gangs that make up the Golden State Skinheads, or GSS, in an anti-Antifa rally at the state capitol in Sacramento. They will be joined by members of the KKK, the National Socialist Movement, and skinhead groups such as Blood and Honor. It is believed that this will be the largest West Coast white power mobilization in many years. As Heimbach stated on a recent podcast, quote, "If we can do it here, we can do it anywhere," end quote. In response, there is a call out for people to shut down the rally starting at 9 a.m. sharp on the west steps of the state capitol in Sacramento. The permit for the fascist rally starts at 11 a.m., and it is believed that they are planning on arriving at the west steps of the Capitol at 12 noon. More background information with links can be found at, get a pen, itsgoingdown.org/national-mobilization-blockade-shut-white-supremacy-Sacramento.
Several inmates being held at Alexander Correctional Institution in Taylorsville, North Carolina, have recently gone on hunger strike in protest of their conditions of confinement. They have been on strike, according to an email we received on Wednesday of this week, due to, quote, the denial of medical treatment, denial of food and officers spitting in food trays, the denial of adequate materials to clean their cells, denial of recreation, sexual and racial discrimination against African Americans in restrictive housing or segregation, and the constant denial of incoming mail, unquote. The prisoners on strike are Stanley Corbett Jr., Jermaine Spellers, and Andrew S. The inmates are also protesting the recent beatings of prisoners in facilities, quote, blind spots, unquote, or areas where there are no cameras. This includes the beating of Brian K. McCoy on February 3rd, 2016, Jonathan Tulin on March 22nd, 2016, Carl Covington on January 5th, 2016, Devin Hyman on February 4th, 2016, and Robert McFadden on April 1st, 2016. This protest comes at a time of increased prisoner organizing, which includes recent riots at Holman Correctional Facility in Atmore, Alabama, mass hunger strikes in Michigan facilities, work stoppages at multiple facilities in Texas, and an announcement of a national coordinated prisoners' strike on the 45th anniversary of the Attica prison uprising on September 9th. Media is encouraged to contact the administration of Alexander to make inquiries. Links can be found to those contacts at ncdps.gov/adult-corrections/prison/prison-facilities/alexander-correctional-institution. What you say, what you say, what you say, what?
Islamophobia is rearing its ugly head here at Warren Correctional. Really, it's been something of a staple of the prison complex dating back to the events leading up to the Lucasville uprising. Back then, prison officials provoked Muslim prisoners by refusing basic accommodations and contributing to even greater tension. When prison officials' nonsense eventually sparked a riot, as part distraction and part spectacle, they framed up Muslim prisoners as leaders of the riot, going so far as to doctor surveillance recordings in order to frame Imam Sadiq Abdullah Hussam, a Muslim prisoner at Lucasville. Sadiq has been on death row ever since, even though experts confirmed that the audio recordings used to put him there were spliced, adding Sadiq into conversations where he wasn't actually present. Yes, Ohio prison officials will go to crazy lengths in order to assassinate Muslim prisoners. Here at Warren Correctional, prison officials haven't proposed killing Muslims yet. But they do possess the heavy equipment to dig the mass grave in the softball diamond, so stay tuned. The latest round of Islamophobic attacks began when mailroom and commissary staff conspired to convince Muslim prisoners that a 30-year policy providing for the purchase of prayer oil was rescinded, when it really wasn't. The lie they told was that prisoners at some other prison were using modified pop cans and desk lamps to burn prayer oil as incense, and as a consequence, prayer oil was banned. It wasn't, of course, but nobody knew that. Recent inquiries to central office reveal that the policy hasn't changed at all. Of course, Muslims have been prevented from prayer oil purchases for months and months, and there still is no clarification as to how Muslim prisoners can go about obtaining it. So the effective ban will likely continue for several more months. Nothing at all has been done to the staff who foreclosed on Muslims' religious rights through fraud. At the same time, prison staffers ban prayer on the recreation yard. While on its face such a ban seems inclusive to every religion, consider that prayer, for everyone but Muslims, can be done inconspicuously. For Muslims, the process of prayer involves a specific ritual of standing and bowing and prostrations, actions that are identifiable as prayer. So when Mustafa Harwell attempted to pray on the recreation yard, he was surrounded by staff and roughly led away. When he wrote up a complaint about it, they called him a gang member and sent him off to Lucasville. He's in K-Block now. So the ODRC, as part of its rehabilitative program, designed to instill greater respect for law, has suspended the Constitution and enforced prayer-free zones. No member of other religions are faced with gang transfers for praying, but Muslims are. Simultaneous to banning prayer oil through fraud and cracking down on communication with Allah, the ODRC refuses to provide Muslims a religious diet, referred to as an halal diet. This is the Muslim equivalent to the Jewish kosher diet. The irony is, the ODRC recognizes kosher diet in policy while denying the Islamic equivalent entirely. All of this taken together gives Muslim prisoners the distinct impression that the ODRC holds a grudge. The situation exemplifies the prison hierarch's silliness, their sneaky provocations that originate from some really deep-seated hatred and hostility, an irrational hatred and hostility, a bigotry born of stupidity that only flourishes in hierarch disorder. So, on the eve of Ramadan, Muslim prisoners in Ohio are praying for basic fundamental accommodations. Well, when the guards aren't looking anyway. This is anarchist prisoner Abu Huraira Asim al-Quraish. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at his new address by directing it to Sean Swain, 243-205, Warren CI, P.O. Box 120, 5787 State Route 63, Lebanon, Ohio, 45036. For updates on his situation, his bid for U.S. president in 2016, and more writings by Sean can be found at seanswain.org.
Hey, I'm Dino Sorceress for The Final Straw, and I'm speaking with Ariana Steger, the daughter of the much-celebrated, long-incarcerated eco-anarchist prisoner Marius Mason. Ariana, thank you so much for taking the time to meet up and being down to put yourself out there on the show.
Thank you for asking me.
Yeah, yes, definitely. I wanted to start by asking what your life looked like before Marius was taken into state custody in 2008. First of all, where were you living up to that time, and what are some of your memories from that period?
Before the arrest, we were living in Cincinnati, Ohio, in a neighborhood called Northside, just in a little two-bedroom apartment with a bunch of cats and a couple dogs. Marius was working at the Waldorf School, and I was in high school. We had a, you know, kind of a normal, like, teenage daughter-parent semi-tumultuous relationship, but we were really close. Took a lot of hikes and drank a lot of coffee together and cooked dinner and, you know, kind of the normal stuff.
That sounds super cozy. Were you living with anybody else at the time, or was it just the two of you?
Marius and my dad had joint custody pretty much since the time I was 4 or 5 when they split.
Mm-hmm.
So I was back and forth about half the week between Marius's place and my dad's house.
You sort of named a few things, but what sort of things would you and your pops do together?
Yeah, coffee was a big thing. Marius got me on the coffee. And cooking, I learned basically everything that I still do when I cook. I learned to start everything with oil and olive oil, garlic, and onion.
Yes!
Learned how to eat vegan really, really cheaply.
Those which
is a useful skill. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We started playing music a little bit together. I'd like just started to pick up the guitar and write.
I guess he had put out Not For Profit in 1999, so did you, like, grow up hearing those songs around the house? Or
yeah, I actually went with him when he went to record it with his friend out in California. Yeah, took that long trip out there.
Wow.
Yeah, I grew up with music and vegan food and radicals.
I guess Marius is perhaps best known for the acts of eco-sabotage and property destruction that he pled guilty to carrying out against the GMO lab at Michigan State and the logging equipment in Messick, Michigan. But I also know that he had a long history of organizing and activism with Earth First, the IWW, Anti-I-69 campaign, and a lot of other labor and environmental struggles and campaigns. Can you talk about Marius's activism in the time that you were growing up and what sort of projects or issues you saw or knew him to be engaged in at the time?
I remember him being just heavily involved in community activism throughout my entire childhood. I grew up doing Food Not Bombs, which I loved. I was there every Saturday or Sunday, depending on which city, helping to cook giant pots of donated food to go share with folks in the park. I remember being really heavily involved in Detroit with the water shutoffs that were happening in Detroit and in Highland Park. And just growing up with the sense that there are people who are animals who are not being treated fairly, and it's our responsibility as like citizens of the world to help them out.
Yeah, totally. I mean, so it seems like that was a pretty open topic between the two of you, not something that like was held back or something that he like kept separate from his home life.
Oh no, I mean, mostly we were either living in collectives or there wasn't really a babysitter, so I was just kind of there.
Being a rad baby.
Yep. Rad baby.
Okay, so to get into, like, I don't know, what I imagine must be trauma, can you talk about your pop's arrest and your house getting raided? Like, how old were you at the time and what was that like?
It's still a crazy day to think about. I was 16 and I think I'd called in sick to school, which I was doing quite a lot of that period. I don't know that I was really sick. I think I just didn't want to go to school. And Marius had just left for work at the Waldorf school. I think they stopped him on his way. So I was the only one at the house, and all of a sudden I woke up to like a pounding on the door and what seemed like about 40, 50 federal agents and police officers just sort of swarmed into the apartment and turned everything on its head. Not really understanding what was going on, knowing that it was about Marius. I remember being instructed just to sit on the staircase and feeling really self-conscious because I was still in my pajamas and I didn't have a bra on or anything.
Yeah.
And had to wait till there was a female officer to use the restroom so that she could accompany me. And
damn.
Yeah, not them not really being able to answer any questions that I had about what was going on. Everything just kind of got turned upside down.
What was your understanding at the time of why the state was taking him, if you had one? I mean, you said you had kind of a sense that, you know, it had to do with your dad, but...
We'd had conversations before in maybe like the month or two prior to the arrest, just taking little private walks where he intimated strongly that there was a chance that he might be going away for a very long time due to actions that had happened in the past. I was never told any more specifics, I think, for my own protection. But Marius did have a way of being very theatrical and passionate and sort of lived in this state of sustained chaos. And so I didn't necessarily take it entirely to heart. I didn't realize the gravity and the severity of what he was actually saying.
Sure.
So when it did happen, it was still a shock, but I at least had some forewarning.
Yeah. I can only imagine what it must have felt like for him to perhaps sense this could happen at any time, and I don't know what's going to happen to me or my family. Talk about some of what you went through after that. Like, your parent had just been abruptly ripped away. Seems like that would be a huge shock to just be thrown into dealing with on a lot of levels. Can you talk about that period, both what you were feeling and what came next for you as far as survival?
Sure. The first couple weeks after the arrest were probably some of the hardest, just because there was so much uncertainty. I didn't actually know where Marius was for about 2 weeks until I got a phone call, and he was finally able to use the phone in jail. But I just knew that they'd taken him somewhere, and I had no idea where. So I was in my dad's custody full-time and just kind of waiting to hear what was going to happen next. When I finally heard from him, at that point my attendance in school had already been pretty spotty, and I made the decision to kind of drop out and go stay with him for the summer while he was on house arrest at my grandma's place in Michigan.
Okay, they were both in Michigan.
So, well, my dad was in Cincinnati at the time, but my grandma was in Michigan.
Okay.
Which is where Marius got sent.
And so you went to stay with your grandma. Mm-hmm. How did she or other adults in your life talk about what was going on? Did you get the sense that they had any more clue than you did, or were people judgmental?
there was a lot of just disbelief and lack of understanding on my family's part. I think they were hurt to see a loved one taken away so abruptly and didn't necessarily understand the reasoning behind the activism.
Yeah.
I tried really hard to get a grasp of the motives of the actions, and, you know, had the opportunity to sit and talk with Marius for months at a time about everything that had happened and kind of reflect and the understanding.
After he was incarcerated or before that?
While he was on house arrest.
Okay.
At my grandma's place.
Okay.
And I'm so thankful for that time. But, I think the understanding that I came to, because, of course, I had the feeling of, like, I was sad that my parent was going to be out of my life, and, like, how could you have done this thing that would have taken you away from your children? You were very young at the time of the actions.
Yeah.
But my understanding was that, like, the actions were as much for me as they were for anybody else on the planet. It was this just overwhelming sense of injustice that needed to be rectified. And I found a lot of empathy, and had a lot of respect for the choices that he made.
Did you get the sense then, or since then, that other family members have been able to come to a similar place of compassion and empathy and even gratitude for those actions, or strung out all over the map still?
Yeah, I would say the empathy and compassion has always been there. I'm so fortunate to be surrounded by the family that I have. Even, you know, with family members where politics differs really, really drastically, there's a huge value placed on family. And, you know, my grandma was writing letters and putting money on commissary and doing everything she could the whole time, even if she didn't really understand the reasoning behind the actions.
Yeah.
Thought that they were extreme or insane.
That's awesome. Sounds like a pretty supportive group.
Oh, absolutely.
So it's been 7, almost 8 years since Marius was taken now. I guess one of my biggest questions is, what has it been like to try and maintain your relationship and deal with other changes in your life with a parent behind bars?
It's different. You know, it's definitely not the same as being able to kind of watch somebody grow up. It's a little bit removed. And I can tell that in his mind sometimes there's sort of this frozen image of, like, the crazed 16-year-old girl that he left behind. So he hasn't watched the whole process that happened after that. But we do stay in touch. We have a weekly phone call. He usually calls once a week still.
That's awesome.
Been able to see him regularly and write letters, which I'm not as good about lately, but still try to, and I love the letters that he writes me so much.
That's awesome. I know that his mail is pretty darn restricted, and that, you know, mail coming into prisoners in general is pretty reviewed and surveilled. Are there any things like that that you've come up against in y'all's attempts to stay connected?
There've been letters that have been lost, and just regular mail frustrations. I think the only issue we really had was when we were trying to practice Spanish together. And I tried to write him a letter in Spanish, and I guess that's just a whole to-do. They have to find, like, an official translator. It took, like, 2 months before it reached
Not
him.
Someone that they hire on in the facility.
Yeah.
They were like, oh, she's trying to smuggle in secret messages and talk about insidious acts, probably.
So after that, I think we tried that once, and then it was a no-go. But for the most part, it's been relatively smooth, considering.
You were saying that you get to visit pretty often, and I know that you're someone who's gotten to go through the Risen Group Fund.
Yes.
Can you talk about what that is and how you got connected with them?
I would love to. Those people have my whole heart. My dad actually, I think it was like the week following Marius's arrest, like pulled out an envelope with information about the Rosenbergs that he'd kind of tucked aside in case things went a certain way with Marius, that he could kind of see might be happening. But yeah, their fund originally started up by the son of the Rosenbergs, and now carried on by the grandkids and other staff members. that has provided me the ability to go visit Marius pretty much free of charge. We've paid flights, hotels, rental cars. They bought me a computer.
Whoa!
Just because I, like, one time said, I'm so sorry that I've missed this granting deadline. It's hard because I don't have a working computer right now. And they're like, oh, well, we'll get you one. We do that sometimes.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's tremendous. I guess for those that don't know, the Rosenberg Fund was set up, what, in the 60s or 70s?
I believe something like that.
By the children of some incarcerated activists, and it's a fund that allows children of, in their own literature, you know, they say children of progressive activists, to visit their folks. And I was pretty impressed with them when I found out that you and your brother were beneficiaries of them, given that the language of their stance is, again, of supporting kids of progressive activists. And I don't know how you look at Marius or if he looks at himself in those terms, but it seems like beyond just the way that the prison industrial and so-called judicial system has looked at him and others who've done similar things as eco-terrorists, it's common for more liberal folks or progressives to take a similar stance and often deny support to anarchists or more direct action-oriented folks. So the fact that y'all have found support through them seems pretty rad to me.
Yeah, yeah, they've been nothing but supportive.
That's, amazing.
And even when I was a super irresponsible teenager and, like, repeatedly missed all of their deadlines, they still went out of their way to make sure that I got to go see them.
So cool. How often do you get to go?
Still usually about twice a year. It was even more in the beginning, just when the separation was so fresh, and it was such a comfort to know that, like, I didn't have to worry about where that money was going to come from. And I, as a 16-year-old, could just be like, I'm going to come see you on your birthday and show up and do it. Yeah.
That sounds like a huge relief. What is it like to physically visit? I know he's been moved around a little bit in the time that he's been in. Like, what are some of your observations of both the different units that he's been in and just how he's been when you've been able to go?
Yeah, Texas is definitely a different situation than Waseca was. Waseca was a moderate security prison, and the visitation was this sort of big cafeteria with all these families, maybe like 20, 30 other families all visiting at once, and you just kind of sit at a table and talk. I think the visitation there was like eight hours for 2 days. So Saturday and Sunday, 8 hours. Yeah, and I did that. My dad was kind enough. I think I spent a Thanksgiving there. Spent my 18th birthday there.
Wow.
Texas is definitely higher security. Mm-hmm. It's a whole process getting in there. My brother and I usually make a point to do at least one visit, just the two of us, each year. And we've sort of got a whole routine where we wake up at 4:30 in the morning and we go eat at Waffle House and then we go wait in line. You have to wait in line in your car just to get onto the prison, which is on a naval base.
Wow.
So you have to wait in line for like an hour and a half to actually get in time to make like the first cycle. And so we listen to All Hail West Texas by the Mountain Goats in line at the prison gates. Then go in, and it's, by the time we see him, it's like 9:30, 10.
Wow, yeah. That's a lengthy intake process.
Yep.
Is there a connection between the prison and the naval base? What's that about?
Not that I'm aware of. I really couldn't tell you.
And are the visitations as long at Carswell as they were at Waseca? I feel like 8 hours per session, or was it split between the 2 days?
Oh, no, 8 hours per session.
That's a lot longer than I would have expected.
Yeah, at Carswell, it's about half that. It's 8 hours split into 2 days.
Okay.
But at Carswell, since he's in the admin unit, which is a much, much smaller contained facility, we actually have our own visitation room. So it's just us and Marius and one prison guard responsible for sitting in on the visit.
Mm-hmm. Are you all allowed to hug when you see him?
Yeah. And they're a little looser. Maybe I shouldn't say that. But because it's just one guard in there. Yeah, I remember at Waseca there were all these regulations on like how long the hugs were supposed to be, which is a really weird thing.
That's so cold.
Yeah, like I let him put on was wearing a ring that he'd given me, and I let him wear it for a minute there, and they like took him in to be strip searched, which didn't follow the logic of. Full body search, because you're not allowed to do that.
I actually printed out some stuff from the internet about the history of Maurice's incarceration and some of the shifts sort of between these two different cages that he's been in that I wanted to read. This is an excerpt first from a now defunct support website, but that was cross-posted to popularresistance.org. So, as you said, Maurice was first sentenced to prison at FCI Waseca. During his time there, he taught fellow inmates to play guitar, helped with writing workshops, and never received a single infraction for his behavior. Despite all of this, in 2010, he was unexpectedly transferred to FMC Carswell. His life in Carswell has been dramatically different. Outside of Fort Worth, Texas, Maurice is over 1,000 miles away from his friends and family in Michigan. He has no access to the prison's general population. Instead, he is confined to the 20-woman prison block he is a part of. His communication with the outside is under close scrutiny, further restricted, and mail correspondence between him and others is routinely delayed or lost. When pressed to explain the transfer, the BOP has refused to provide an answer or hearing. And then this is from supportmariusmason.org. Marius is incarcerated in the High Security Administration Unit at the Federal Medical Center, Carswell, in Fort Worth, Texas. According to the prison's own literature, the unit is, quote, designed for female inmates with histories of escapes, chronic behavior problems, repeated incidents of assaultive or predatory behavior, or other special management concerns, end quote. Maurice has never violated any prison rules. Clearly, he's being held in this unit because of his political beliefs and in an effort to silence him. Maurice's gymnasium-sized unit, housing up to 20 prisoners, causes severe distress and worsens the debilitating mental illness and PTSD from which some of the prisoners suffer. The confinement and isolation result in periodic acts of violence and suicide attempts as women struggle to maintain sanity in these conditions. The prisoners are only allowed to exercise in a small, fenced-in, concrete outdoor area topped by double-coiled razor wire where there is little room for physical activity. The unit is frequently and unpredictably locked down for hours on end due to violence and suicide attempts resulting from the claustrophobic and oppressive conditions. Prisoners leave the building for medical treatment, but only after a protracted wait and fierce advocacy on the part of the prisoner, even though Carswell is ostensibly a medical facility. Access to mental health counseling, medical care, and educational opportunities are greatly diminished because of security issues. End quote. And this is all on top of the already intensely punitive nature of being separated from one's loved ones and the natural world. And I think about how, for someone like Maurice, who so clearly has such a deep love and reverence for the wild and other living beings on the planet, how this separation would be particularly torturous. I mean, I imagine that the majority of people in prison, whether they ever considered themselves nature lovers or eco-activists before, suffer when predominantly isolated from fresh air and trees and birds and other life, aside from what limited time they might at best get in the yard. So for someone like Maurice, who spent his life fighting to defend life, how especially crushing and likely taxing on his mental health being locked up would be in that regard. Can you speak at all to how you feel like he's held up under these circumstances, both from what you've been able to observe or perceive or anything that he's told you about it?
The cage, the outdoor cage, is kind of visible from the visitation area just through a window, and looking at it just makes my heart sick. Yeah, the idea that that's the only experience of the outdoors that he's had or possibly will have for years is insane and I feel inhumane. He's, you know, I'm his daughter and I know that he, I think that there's ways in which he suffers that he kind of wants to protect me from and not express. Mm-hmm. But I do see, I see a change. Just a pain and a weariness in his eyes and demeanor.
Yeah, no doubt.
In seeing him. Yeah, and I know how valuable it was to be able to teach guitar. I think he was playing in a couple of bands that he'd started in Waseca.
Yeah, there was something online about Razor Wire. Did you ever get to hear any of their music?
I've never
heard
the music. I've seen band photos, which were great. Yeah, that looked pretty badass. Yeah, and missing that. He does have access to music, but it's pretty sporadic. And with the frequent lockdowns there, I'm always hearing about, like, phone calls will get cut short, or we'll miss our weekly phone call because they were locked down unpredictably.
Totally. That sucks. Does he still have access to instruments at Carswell?
As far as I know, just guitars, and I think there's, like, a severely out-of-tune piano. But he is able to play the guitar, just not super reliably.
Yeah, it definitely seems like, based on what has found its way to his support website, like, art and poetry and music are just completely vital outlets for his resiliency. For folks who don't know, Marius has produced a ton of art and poetry over the years that he's been locked up, much of which you can view online at supportmariusmason.org, under the art and poetry section. And some really incredible stuff that continues to be very political, very educational and awareness-raising, very connected and reflective on different social and environmental issues.
Yeah, I've loved watching his art progress in there. I know that was a thing. I mean, he's always been an artist and a musician, but with being so heavily involved in activism and kind of living on the fringe and having to work multiple jobs, that was a thing that there wasn't much time for, and now there's nothing but time, and it's essential for survival. So yeah, I love seeing everything that he's painting and working on.
Yeah, it's totally inspiring to see how even behind bars he's not only continuing to create this work that's clearly a sign of his own vitality and survival, but that's also such a salient contribution to his activism still, and a continuation of that. And Ariana, you are also a musician. You play guitar and sing and write your own music. You already mentioned that you first started playing, learning guitar from Marius.
Yeah, I think I was actually too stubborn to really take a lesson from him or anybody else, but but I learned on his guitar, which I still currently have.
Mm, that's special. Is your music something that you've ever gotten to share with him?
Yeah, I just started writing right before he was incarcerated. And there have been times where I've played things that I've been working on over the phone, or sing something a cappella. I think he's even had friends, like, look up my SoundCloud and, like, try to play things through the speakers on phone calls.
I'm sure that's meant the world to him to hear.
Yeah, we have tried to correspond musically a little bit, which is very tricky with somebody who's incarcerated, especially with me not really having much knowledge of formal notation or anything. But
you guys have tried. Write each other scores and mail them back and forth.
He's better with it than I am. I can write out lyrics and chords and then kind of sing him the melody over the phone so he gets an idea. But he's expressed an interest in wanting to hear what I'm playing and potentially learn some work on them himself.
And he's still writing his own behind bars that he's sending to you occasionally too?
He's writing music, from what I understand there, has been tricky. I think he's pretty much never allowed to be alone with a guitar. Mm-hmm. It's always just sort of during rec time. Okay. So there's, you know, all sorts of hustle and bustle around him where people saying, like, play Freebird. So he's expressed frustration in not being able to write much musically. But he's been working on learning some old covers. Some Against Me, I think he was talking about, actually.
Yes. Man, the Freebird request, even behind bars. There's no escape. Would you be willing to play us a song?
I would love to.
Yeah, do you want to talk about the song at all first?
Sure. This is a song, I think I wrote it at about 19, coming back to Pennsylvania right after visiting Marius, and just feeling feeling really emotional and missing him, and I wrote a song called Ashes. And I'll try to wipe the ashes from your eyelids just to see your eyes. This is not goodbye. This is not goodbye. Maybe not this time. And I know this world hits the soul like ashes hit the snow in yours. So pure and glorious. So then don't break my heart again. Don't make me watch yours harden. And I know you must have heard me when I cry. This is not goodbye. This is not.
Such a powerful, beautiful song. Thank you so much for playing.
Thanks. It's the first time I've played it in years.
Wow. How often are you playing in town these days? Do you?
Well, right now, the coolest thing that I get to do is I have a regular weekly spot, just on a voluntary basis, doing music therapy with a women's treatment facility, a women's drug and alcohol rehab facility downtown. So I go there every Friday and play music there with a friend. And it's been the coolest thing that I've ever gotten to do.
Wow. And you're about to go back to school for music therapy. Soon, you're saying?
Mm-hmm.
Does it seem like the kind of thing that, I mean, you've probably gotten to talk to your pops about it at this time, but I could only imagine him just swelling with pride to know that.
Yeah, he's a proud papa, for sure.
I mean, speaking of your papa, so Marius came out as trans, what has it been now, a couple years ago? Is it been that long already?
About 2 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the last that I heard, the prison still wasn't recognizing him by his chosen name, was returning mail that was addressed to it, and was blocking access to hormones or any further transitional treatment. Have you heard much of what his experience with that has been like?
It looked like there sort of was a little bit of progress, and that it kind of got uprooted. For a while, they were really okay with people maybe not writing Marius as the address on a letter, but at least writing M instead. Mm-hmm. And then there was an announcement from the prison saying that you have to write Marie. You have to use your former name, not the letter M.
Wow.
And that's been hard. I think you said the hardest thing is that he has to do like a name identification on every time he makes a phone call. Every time he calls out, he has to use his dead name.
Yeah. That's
and usually say it repeatedly because the sound is faulty on old prison phones.
I mean, and this is to say nothing of how many times I'm sure he has to hear it day in and day out from people on the inside too, or at least prison administration, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Have you heard anything about, like, if he's out to other inmates and if he's found much affinity or support there, or conversely, if he's faced any harassment from guards or other inmates specific to that?
I haven't uh, I haven't heard any specific cases of harassment yet.
That's good.
I think he's been pretty open about it, and people might not necessarily get it, or they just kind of think that it's cute or funny, but he hasn't, to my knowledge at least yet, received any, been singled out or bullied for it.
That's solid. I can imagine that in many ways it might not necessarily be that much different than if he were on the outside in that regard.
There was one instance, I think it was a guard or something. I don't know who this person was, and it certainly should have been somebody who would know better, but I know that he was asked if he had his original plumbing.
Jeez.
Pretty crude.
Yep, that question. Again, unavoidable bullshit.
Right. I just can't. I mean, that's not a thing that I think of when I meet people.
Yeah.
What do your genitals just look like?
Yeah, people think they're so entitled to just know everything about you and really need to find that information for their own peace of mind just to have a conversation. It's pretty sick.
It's pretty bogus.
Says a lot about them and the culture that we're raised in. It seems like just yet another testament, despite that, to how strong he's continued to stand and act from behind the bars, was his last January 22nd when he called for an International Day of Solidarity with all trans prisoners. And in the statement that he sent out for the day, he said, "Sovereignty over ourselves, our bodies, is essential for any other kind of liberty to be possible. By reaching out to trans prisoners, you affirm their right to define themselves for themselves and defend them against the overwhelming voices who claim that they do not exist, that they must allow others to define them. In the isolating environment of prison, this is toxic and intimidating and amounts to the cruelest form of psychological torture. By offering your help and solidarity, you may just save a life. I know that for the last year and a half, as I have struggled to assert myself as a trans man, as I have advocated for the relief of appropriate medical care for my gender dysphoria, it has been the gentle and loving reminders of my extended family of supporters who have given me strength and courage to continue. Please join me in offering this help to so many others who need it to keep going. Never underestimate the healing power of a letter. Those letters have kept me going, and I want to pass that gift on if you will help me." And then if I recall correctly, after he sent out the initial call for the day, they then froze his mail out entirely for a while, right? I guess by now it's been reinstated and he's been able to reestablish contact, but did you all get to talk at all about how it went or how he felt like it went?
We spoke, I think, relatively shortly after the event. That's right. That was around the time that he was placed in solitary.
Yeah,
that's right. I didn't even realize that it coincided with the event directly. Yeah, we were able to speak afterwards, and I was able to tell him about it. I just had a little, like, letter-writing tea party at my place and took pictures.
That's awesome. Yeah, I remember hearing that after having put the call out there, they just stopped his mail for a while, and so he didn't even know whether it was actually moving forward or getting any kind of updates about it, and I can only imagine what an incredible feeling it must have been to eventually find out, yeah, it totally happened, and, like, all these things around the world and around the country on that day. And I know in Asheville we had we were supposed to have a letter writing night on the day, and then that was the Asheville snowpocalypse of 2016.
We also had a snowpocalypse. Yeah.
All it takes is a couple inches and everything shuts down. And But we did reschedule and had a super solid turnout and little event. So that's cool to hear that y'all were repping it from here too.
Even in the snowpocalypse, that's right. There were still like 4 or 5 people who showed up. I had no idea what it was going to be like.
That's awesome. I mean, I think that's a kind of a good segue. You're just saying, you know, who's actually going to turn out for these things, to this concept in your life of the fact that your pops is kind of a celebrity dad. What does it feel like to have a political prisoner for a parent who, at least in certain circles, is very well known and seemingly has a relatively large support network? Like, when you and I met super randomly last summer and you sort of pegged me within the first minute or so of us talking that I was someone who might know who your dad was, I was kind of wondering, how often does this happen, and how does it feel when it does?
It feels like less frequently lately, especially, you know, with more years between the time of the arrest, and less frequently in Louisville, a little further from you know, places where Marius has lived and hubs of support.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely in Cincinnati, right after the time of his arrest, it was almost overwhelming. Like, there are a lot of people who were very well-meaning and excited about the things that Marius stood for.
Yeah.
But I would, you know, run into kids at bars all the time. They'd be like, this is your parrot. That's awesome. It's like, yeah, it is, but it also sucks because I miss him.
Right.
So it was a little bit overwhelming. Same in Kalamazoo. Like, I would walk into a collective and see, like, a picture of his face on a poster up on the wall. I didn't know these people. But no, it hasn't been so overwhelming in the past few years. And only among certain circles, and obviously, like, all of my close friends know the situation and know about my pops, but a lot of people I know wouldn't necessarily have known who he was if
sure.
they didn't know me and I hadn't explained the situation.
Sure. Yeah, I imagine in Louisville it's maybe not as densely concentrated a place of people being tuned into that sort of thing.
Right.
But, you know, you find your affinity where you can. Has Maurice's network of support reached out or engaged with you much over the years? I mean, like you were saying, maybe that was kind of overwhelming at times at first. But I guess since then, and as you've become more far-flung from y'all's hometown and places that you live together, have people kept in touch and asked you, checked in, you know, about what your needs have been through this?
Yeah, I will pretty routinely, if Marius is having trouble reaching me for maybe a 2-3 week period, I'll get a call from one of his friends or somebody in the support network, like, your pops just wants to know that you're alive, which is very sweet.
Yeah.
He's doing worse. Definitely when I moved to Kalamazoo, like, people that were activists and supporters were some of the first friends that I made in the town. Took the hour drive to transport me to the county jail to go visit him, like, every single weekend. Made it clear that if there was anything that I needed, he was there. So people have been really, really helpful. And definitely felt love.
That's
on that end.
Yeah, that's really good to hear. I definitely worry that when people get kind of blown up in these ways, as just icons almost of the struggle, and, you know, not without due reason, of course, but that family, you know, could get left behind. But I think that's to the credit of the people that he had in his life as friends and chosen family at that time, that people have been able to show up for you in that way. It's super, super neat.
Absolutely.
Do you feel like there's any ways that supporters or other friends could step it up a little harder, or getting pretty much what you need at this point? I mean, for you or Marius as well?
Oh, I mean, I feel perfectly, perfectly content. I don't think there's anything that I need. I think just letters and more letters. I think that's been the most valuable thing that he's received, is just continuous contact with the outside world.
Yeah.
Current events, art, just anything coming in.
Yeah.
That's been the most important thing.
Does he have access to internet or anything at Carswell, or is most of what he's... I mean, I guess, again, I've been so amazed by the amount of politicization of his artwork and poetry that I've seen put on the web, that I'm like, well, clearly he's getting access to this information. And I don't know, this is true of other political prisoners too, like Lumia Abu-Jamal's commentaries. I'm like, how do you even find all this out? Is that mostly coming through correspondence, you think, or does he have computer time at all?
Not computer time. They have, like, a prison email system, but I think that's the only thing they're allowed to do. They're not allowed to, like, surf the web.
Sure.
But yeah, he's definitely oftentimes more up to date on current events than I am.
Yeah.
Here in the outside world.
Yeah,
a combination of who he's corresponding with, and he listens to a lot of NPR too. He's got a little radio, and I think it's just kind of constantly on NPR. So between those two things, he stays informed.
Cool. Is that the kind of thing that he's had taken away, I would imagine, when he's been in isolation?
I think he was mentioning he was actually nervous about being put in isolation recently. I'm still waiting to hear what happens with that.
Okay.
I think he was mentioning that he could have a radio there. He actually has an iPod most of the time, like a prison database iPod. I'm sure it's nothing too fancy.
Pre-approved songs,
yeah, lots
or
of pre-approved
only,
tracks.
Only guard picks. Jeez.
Yeah. No. Apparently, he's found some. He's found some good stuff. I think he's been listening to his "Against Me" on the iPod, which is great. But yeah, he. I don't think he can take that in there, but he can't have a radio. At least
something.
Something.
To change the topic a little bit, I know in fall of 2013 there was a campaign launched to try and move him out of Carswell and closer to family in Michigan. Do you know if that campaign is still active or going on or where it's at?
I haven't heard much of anything. I know immediately after, like, I got a lot of friends to participate, and there was a national call-in day, and a lot of people were asking me for updates, you know, afterwards, like, do you know what's going to happen? And pretty much my understanding was that, like, nobody was going to know anything for security reasons until all of a sudden we get a call from Marius and he's like, I'm somewhere else now.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I haven't heard anything
on that
front.
I couldn't find anything online to verify it still being active. The website seemed kind of defunct, but figured it was worth a shot. Other than the support that you give him on a personal level, Have you ever participated in any of the more formal organizing of support for him alongside others? Like you were saying, the letter writing night, January 22nd, you were holding down. Have you been involved in June 11th stuff in the past?
That was the first thing that I've hosted. I definitely after his arrest had a lot of fear. I think in drawing more attention to myself, and he had a lot of fear for me too, as already being a target.
Sure.
So I would attend events and benefits and go see music and thank folks for coming out and supporting, but I tried to kind of stay more back on the sidelines.
Yeah, that makes a lot of
sense. Yeah, but lately I've felt a lot more comfortable and confident to host things that are purely innocent, above board. Just let's write letters to people.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what loving humans do for each other.
Mm-hmm. I want to return to that topic a little bit later, but that makes a lot of sense. You got to do what you got to do to keep yourself safe. And I'm sure having a parent taken away for potentially 2 decades would have nothing less than a chilling effect. Obviously, it has broadly in the movement, but on immediate family, I can begin to imagine. And then, returning to his time in segregation, I know that last year he received some major backlash for having sent a statement of support out around June 11th and got thrown in the shoe for a couple months. The special housing unit, what Fifth Estate has called a sanitized phrase for solitary.
Mm-hmm.
I know he got out sometime last August, but have you seen him since then?
Yeah, I saw him most recently at the end of February.
Solid. How'd he seem to be doing?
I'm pretty reasonable. He seems in good enough health, and it's definitely happy to have a visit.
Ultimately, what I believe I saw on that whole debacle was that information that he had been trying to find out from his lawyer whether it was okay for him to even send a message of support,
right,
ended up getting cracked down upon because he didn't send it in the right way, or the lawyer sent it to the support team and Marius was supposed to send it himself or something, and they found this loophole to penalize him further. But you were saying that this is maybe, no one knows why this most recent threat of being thrown in lockdown again is coming up.
It's another one of those things. I think I don't understand prison politics, and I don't think that I'm ever going to.
Does anyone really?
Yeah, any more than Marius does.
Yeah.
So it's more just what I do see is that he's just honestly trying to follow a set of rules that are kind of arbitrary could potentially be subject to change.
Absolutely.
Depending on convenience at any moment. And
whims of one's torturers. I mean.
Yeah, and every once in a while, with all good intentions, he finds out that he's done something wrong and has to pay the consequences for it.
Yeah. Prison!
Yeah. So, okay, yeah, to go back to that topic of being Maurice's kid, how has it affected you personally in the way of state intimidation and the way that you lead your life? I remember you telling me a little while ago about the feds calling you on the phone several years back and trying to harass you or get information or something, and I don't know if there's been any other things like that, but how the sum of that experience, having your house raided, being interrogated, and the extreme example that they've tried to make of your pops altogether, have those things impacted you?
It's been much less noticeable or acute in the past few years. Like, during the time immediately after Marius's arrest, there was pretty much consistently, like, a white F-250 parked outside of my dad's house.
Yeah.
There was just constantly somebody there, and I would occasionally go out and ask them if they wanted coffee, and my dad didn't like that.
On their face?
Kind of peel away.
Yeah.
And then there was the phone call, which was years later. That was after I'd already gone to school in Colorado and moved to Pennsylvania, and I think it was about 19, 20, and I got a call on my cell phone saying, this is the FBI, and we were just kind of wondering if you shared any of the same goals or ideas as your parent. And it almost made me, like, a little bit less scared, because I was like, well, they're clearly shooting in the dark right now.
Right.
It was like, no, and I really don't call me on the phone anymore. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. But since then, there hasn't been much in the way of, like, outright harassment or interaction.
Mm-hmm.
My brother is perpetually on watch, like restricted travel.
Mm.
Directly because of Marius and because of things that Frank, my former stepdad, tried to implicate my brother in years ago. So he's still feeling that in ways that I'm not. I kind of breeze through airport security and I almost feel like I've gotten away with something. And
wow.
He gets the full body pat down.
Yeah.
And everything. Every single time.
Unbelievable. Do you have any words on the subject of Frank Ambrose? Is that anything you want to vent about? Or, I mean, did you ever have to live with that guy for a while? You were saying.
Oh, yeah. He was my stepdad from 8 to 16. I don't think that I have a kind word to say about the man. I've done a lot of writing, a lot of burning that writing, a lot of screaming, a lot of therapy.
Sure enough.
Yeah, and I think I'm just at a place now where I don't understand and may never understand how people can be so horrible to each other.
Yeah, despicable, the things that people will do to try and keep their own asses out of the fire, and really doesn't seem like that worked out ultimately, like, so much in his favor. I mean, I think he still had to serve
9 years.
9 years,
yeah.
I mean,
the better part of 9 years.
To the incredible amount of people that he informed in something like 150 around the country.
They said he set a new high water mark.
Yeah. All time lows in anarchist history.
Yeah.
But, yeah, well, good for you for finding your own catharsis and being rid of that despicable character. I guess my last question is, are there any ways that you've dealt with that or any outlooks that you find helpful in trying to live your life without fear?
Well, I think I dealt with it for a while, just sort of by avoiding putting myself in any situation that might look like dissent, even things that were totally above board.
Mm-hmm.
And then within the past couple years, I just I felt the fear sort of leave, and I follow my heart, and, you know, my my work and passions aren't necessarily activism in the way that my mother was involved. I do a lot of work within the community of people struggling with alcoholism and addiction, and playing music, and healing through massage therapy, things like that. I don't feel afraid to speak my piece anymore, and I think that it's important to continue to do so.
Yeah. Well, you get to be your own person, and you don't have to be your dad doing, you know, you get to do you, and I think that's awesome that you have grown more strength to be able to express yourself, like, as courageously as you do and are, and, yeah, thank you so much again for doing this interview. Is there anything else that you'd like to add or feel like we've left uncovered?
We've touched on most of it. I'll say, I think the thing that I admire most about Marius, that family and even close friends have kind of expressed frustration towards, is his refusal to buckle or apologize for the actions taken,
absolutely,
the heart behind the actions.
Absolutely.
Because even though, like, the thoughts coming from family might have been that maybe there could have been a reduced sentence or time served might have been kinder, the reality is that I think in him standing firm in who he is and what's gotten him into the position where he is, has kept the flow of support steady. It's kept him connected, and that's been, I think, 20 years with that versus 10 without it, is better. It's a fuller life.
I'd agree. It is a completely admirable stance to see someone remain that true to their principles and not sell out in that way.
He's still vegan too. Like, we went vegan at the same time I've been eating pizza, and he's in prison and he's still vegan.
Yeah. Has he ever had any trouble, like, getting those dietary needs met? Like, that's a pretty common thing.
Very, very much. Lots of creative ramen cooking from what I hear.
Yeah.
Lots of PB&J. Yeah. But he's doing it hardcore.
Wow. Well, props to your pops. Mm-hmm. And props again to you. Thanks so much again, Ariana.
Thank you so much for letting me do this.
You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. Next up is Poetry and Literature with Jeff and Lockie on Wordplay.